This is William Del Pilar, your conservative Latin.
I'm rolling my R's. William Del Pilar.
There you go. I am the conservative Latino here with my buddy Big John, and we are with SportsGrumblings.com. Some of you may know me again as involved in politics, but both Big John and I are fantasy sports pioneers, pioneering the industry and helping to commercialize it into a multi-billion dollar industry with thousands of jobs.
We did all that?
I don't think it looks like it because we haven't collected a check, have we? Well, we're here tonight to talk some politics. SportsGrumblings.com is about sports and politics. There's a lot happening in the world. And what you may not realize, there's a lot happening in the local world, not just the Ukraine-Russian conflict. And by local world, I'm talking about the district attorneys across the country. Right now, everybody's poster child for conservatives attack is George Soros. In this case, it's appropriate. George Soros has banked, putting a lot of money into DA races across the country. Now he's smart. I would have done this decades ago had I been him. The way you control a city or you control aspects of what you want to accomplish is through politics and through district attorneys. And one of those district attorneys is George Gascon. So we're bringing a guest on who was involved in the thick of the recall Gascon phase. And Gascon has become the poster child for the Soros DAs. And this lady will tell us a lot more about it. So without any further ado, or rather first, John, any words before we get going?
Just very quickly, I want to say I love your intro. I'm no fan of overly liberal policies, but I will say where we do diverge is, and I'd love to talk to our guest about this, is to throw in some libertarian principles in general of no victim, no crime. So I want to see how that fits into the whole conversation as well.
And that's where I kind of pat myself on the back because I sent Big John a note earlier and said, I want your libertarian take on this topic. So make sure you read up on it. But without further ado, let me introduce you all to Ms. Karen Roseberry. Ms. Karen Roseberry is a California native with a bachelor's and master's degree in political science. She spent years working in education, politics, and project management. Karen has managed state assembly and congressional races and worked in varying capacities in state, senate, and gubernatorial races. She was also a 2016 candidate for California's U.S. Senate seat. Her focus and passion includes grassroots cultivation, training, and development. So let's welcome Ms. Karen Roseberry. Welcome, and thank you for taking time out to educate us all.
Well, I'm happy to be here, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Well, let's get right into it. Well, first of all, full transparency, I've known Karen since about 2018. We met, I think, at a John, he ran for governor. Oh, my God, what's John Cox, at a John Cox event in downtown San Diego. We've never had the opportunity to work together. She's in a different city, but I've known her since then. And we've had a few conversations, thus why I asked her to come on. I know she has worked within the inner circles of this Gascon war. So let's get into it, Karen. First of all, who is George Gascon, and why has he become the national face of everything that's gone wrong with the George Soros-backed district attorneys?
Excellent question. Well, George Gascon is the district attorney of Los Angeles County. He actually was a former district attorney of San Francisco. He received his appointment for the San Francisco DA by none other than Governor Newsom. So we can thank Governor Newsom for DA Gascon's disastrous efforts in San Francisco and his disastrous efforts in Los Angeles County, because he used San Francisco to springboard into Los Angeles County. And we can actually see San Francisco actually kind of rebelling against that. They have their own recall going on. It will actually be on the primary ballot against Chesa Boudin, who was the DA that would replace Gascon after Gascon decided to come to Los Angeles, unfortunately. So Gascon ran on a progressive platform. Many people actually suggest that he's simply doing that for which he campaigned. And part of that is true, and then part of that is not. Much of what he's doing is not anything that was referenced during his campaign. He did not indicate that he was going to stop prosecuting over a dozen misdemeanor crimes. He did not indicate that he would not be prosecuting any special enhancements, including gang affiliations, including gun charges used in the commission of crimes. Some of the other aspects of that, you know, are for more debate. Californians have consistently actually upheld the death penalty, yet Newsom and Gascon refused to actually seek it in any cases. He actually did put forth in his campaign, so can't specifically fault him for it, though I'm not sure that voters really understood the ramifications of that, nor do I think that there was really a proper understanding of the fact that it has actually been supported consistently by Californians, though in Los Angeles County does swing a little more on the liberal side, may not have actually gone through in the 2016 ballot initiative within the county.
Karen, though,
yeah, please.
Real quick, his background. I found his background fascinating. Gascon came here, I believe, as a teenager to L.A. from Cuba. His parents fled Cuba. I have never met an immigrant Cuban and the first generation kid that are not conservative, and I'm sure they existed, and now I know for sure because Gascon is one of them. However, Gascon's rise to power was through law enforcement. He was a cop in L.A., rose all the way up to become assistant chief, and then got the top job, I don't want to say in Mesa, Arizona, and then in San Francisco. And a little tidbit here for the audience, he was appointed, as Karen said, by Governor Newsom, but Big John, this may surprise you, he replaced a certain vice presidential individual we know.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris. You know? So she was appointed attorney general, and obviously I don't care for her, but let's give that woman the American dream credit. She's a vice president now. But anyway, he replaced her. How does somebody with a traditionally conservative background in law enforcement make a 180 degree to want to incarcerate cops and let people off simply because of their color? Because to me, that's what it boils down to. His first criteria, he wants to look at the individuals incarcerated based off color and then review their cases. And then he wants, on the cop judging, I don't know if he's actually began the process of reviewing about 300 cases, if I'm correct, that Jackie Lacey chose not to pursue. Any insight or any thoughts as to how somebody can make a 180 degree turn like that? Or from you too, John, either one. But we'll start with Karen.
All right. Well, there's a little speculation on that, and I don't necessarily know that it's been substantiated one way or the other. You are correct that he did have a career in law enforcement. He also actually served in the military. And both of those he actually doesn't speak of with extremely high regard. Some of the speculation that's actually been put forth is that perhaps there were actions, there was behavior, there were experiences in his, whether it was military career or his law enforcement career, of which he's just terribly not proud. There's been some rumor and speculation of some removal of records. It was part of a time frame aspect of this, but there was a question of whether or not those records that were no longer going to be accessible to the public had things in them that would be unfavorable to Gascon. I've heard rumors of even things like sexual harassment, you know, just very questionable things in regards to his career, in regards to his time in law enforcement that perhaps, again, not proud of. And so now in some sort of twisted way of making amends or, you know, trying to, you know, I wouldn't even say it's his conscience. I would just say that I think, you know, there could be something in his past that haunts him and could be driving this. There's also very distinctly the fact that he just has a thirst for power, and he believes that this is a train that he can ride, whether it's Soros' money or whether this is just the new wave of progressivism that we're seeing sweep through district attorney positions throughout the country. All of those, you know, could be there. I mean, he saw his predecessor from San Francisco, now as a vice president. And so he just wants to, you know, have that sort of pathway of power and abuse of power to come his way.
Big John, any thoughts?
Yeah.
Look at change of person.
Yeah. So I was going to say, just being someone who's not a native Californian, and I'm actually on the other side of the country, I'm in New York. So, and it's interesting to me always to compare the two, right? Like, so we have our New York cops and our California LA cops, the, you know, what we would out here would typically see on TV. So to some extent, I have to say, like, so for example, the situation with the Rampart situation, right, where there were all these dirty cops running around, and was that ever fully resolved? Is that maybe part – now, William always admonishes me, him being the good Republican conservative and me being more of the wacky libertarian, he'll always admonish me that, you know, you have to have a touch of pragmatism. You can't always – be 100% aligned with ideals.
Reality check.
So is it possible that we are now tilting completely to the other side, perhaps, in order to make some sort of ideological amends? Like, look, there's nothing to me as a libertarian scarier than an authoritarian police force. People who think that they are the judges, who they are the lawmakers, right? To me, there's nothing scarier. And isn't that what we always talk about in fascist states, right?
I can answer directly to that, John.
Sure.
I have been jacked up by the cops not once, but twice. One time was really my fault. Even though the cop was abusive, I kind of encouraged him to become more abusive because I got angry.
Sure.
And people who know me go, yeah, that's, I can see that. But I have been abused by a cop, and it took my executive officer to pull my fat out of the fire because he knew my emotion and my temper, but he also knew I was one of his best sailors, and he also knew how cops could be. Now, that said,
wasn't Gascon also, you mentioned his military service.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was an MP, wasn't he, basically?
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
He probably saw things also that probably curled him, and I did too. Hmm. The difference between somebody like myself and Gascon is how you take it and how you accept it.
Oh, sure.
So, for example, people will always tell us, Democrats, and I agree, you never judge a whole culture or race by that one idiot.
Sure.
But on the flip side, they want to blame all cops by one or two people. And I'm not saying that's Gascon, but I have seen people in the military where that happens. They just do not like authority unless they are the authority.
Sure.
And they grow to personally hate that, and it builds and festers. And I ask you the question as a host, but that's what I see may have happened with them. At the end of the day, we're all speculating, and we could talk for hours. But I do want to move on to one aspect of Gascon.
Well, I'd like to actually answer John's point, though, because I think he raised a very good aspect as to whether or not something like Rampart and the police scandals, you know, have had an effect. And I do think that there is somewhat of a ability to use that by – a talking point, if you will.
Sure.
It's that type of thing. It's the George Floyd incident. It's those cases that arise where you get knee-jerk responses and the pendulum swinging of, for example, the defund the police movement. However, we've also seen that knee-jerk response has not been universally accepted, nor has it lasted very long. Even in Minneapolis, they no longer were supportive of that defund the police movement.
Sure.
And so is it still going to be there because there hasn't been a complete and total resolution? Very likely. Not quite sure how you get that level of resolution with extremists that will always revert back to those talking points. And there are extremists on both sides, but that's really what it comes down to. At some point, we do need to acknowledge that there have been tremendous reforms. Has there been, you know, abuse of police power? Certainly.
Yeah.
But we are far from that authoritarian state. And I find it far more concerning when you have a district attorney who takes the law into his own hands and says, I'm not going to prosecute this whole section of the penal code. That is authoritarian.
Well, I agree with
you. In my opinion, much more so than the abusive cop that does get called out and stopped.
Real quick for the audience. When you say, fall back on talking points, what you're saying is they're using something pretty much as an excuse to further whatever goal they want.
Definitely. Sure. It becomes a blanket, you know, excuse. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, what's John. I was going to say, what's interesting to me is there's a couple of points in there, and now William has to keep me on track, but here's the thing. So, for example, it makes you wonder, because when Gascon, when his family came to this country, they basically fled Castro's Cuba. So if anyone should be aware of a police state and the pitfalls thereof, right, it should be Gascon, right?
You would think, exactly.
And to William's earlier point, most Cuban-American immigrants, first generation, they came from that Bay of Pigs incident, so they were very pro-Republican because of the way the Democrats under Kennedy handled them, right? So they were like, hey, you know, give us a gun and we'll go fight, you know, but they got abandoned, right, on the beach. So that's where that original conservatism is. But I think if you looked at the trends of the first generation after the parents that were born in the U.S., especially like what's the Cuban stronghold politically is Florida, right, mm-hmm. Miami. So if you look down there, it's trending more 50-50 now. It's not a dependable Republican bloc anymore.
Okay, I can answer that too. First generation conservative, 90-plus percent
yes.
Republican voters. Second generation, which is the Spanglish. They know their culture. They know how to speak Spanish and English. They're still rooted. They tend
the Marco to be, Rubios actually. Yeah.
Yeah, like they tend Marco to be Rubio. Conservative. It's the third generation that is Americanized, doesn't speak the language. They're the first, and not just Cubans. I'm talking Latinos, which Cubans do fall under. It's the third generation where you're just Latino. So we're
not
from?
Latinx,
I don't know.
Right? Latinx? Huh? Latinx?
Yeah. No, that's the third generation would accept that. You know?
Of course.
The point
of
is,
course.
They yes. become Americanized, but they also accept the culture for, as Karen said, when it suits them as a talking point. And oh. and I've done a lot of studying in this, honestly, because of a previous project, marketing, wanting to do politics and Latinos. And it's quite fascinating. Again, though, I'm starting to digress. Now, one thing I wanted to not forget to mention for Karen to explain is something here that is very California-centric, but it's one of the biggest propositions or laws, Karen can clarify, that we have that Gascon authored, and that is Prop 47. But before we get to Prop 47, John, I didn't want to cut you off. Do you have any final comments on what you were saying?
Yeah, look, to me, I'm very interested in understanding the refusal to apply the law as written. So,
especially for a district attorney.
So, full disclosure, I'm anti-death penalty.
Right. Hey, John, we're going to get to that.
No, but I just want to add that here in New York, we had a DA in the Bronx who flat out said, I refuse under Pataki to put the death penalty in play, even for murder one. You know, so it was just – and even though he personally is against it, which I respect, the law is the law. So to have a district attorney just flat out say, I don't care what the law is, which is beyond prosecutorial discretion, right? It's just saying there is no case, even if 20 Mansons right. come before me, I'm not going to prosecute them under capital charges, right? So to me, that's very wrong. I agree with you guys 100% on that, even though I actually am against the death penalty. I do agree that if it's the law, it's the law. It should be applied.
Well, it's even a little worse on that, and this will actually, I think, connect both of the points that we want to make about this, because there's also not even right now, with the lack of prosecution of special enhancements, an ability to actually get a sentence of life without parole. So there are certainly district attorneys, I think, in the office, and there are, you know, certainly Californians that, you know, would make a case for, you know, not being for the death penalty. That's a whole other debate to be had the merits of, you know, when it should be there, when it shouldn't, what California people, again, have consistently upheld. But the point is that even those people that would be opposed to the death penalty almost always will cite, well, that's why we have life without parole. Okay, but we don't even have that under Gascon.
That's
if
right.
he doesn't actually prosecute the special enhancements and actually add those charges, he won't even get that as a sentence.
We're gonna get to that. I'm trying to be orderly fashion to educate the audience as well, because I can tell you right now, even the most educated PhD person may not know what special enhancements are because it's not part of their job or industry. So we'll get to this stuff. If you can tell us a little bit about Prop 47, what it entails in terms of and how it got to be.
Sure. So Prop 47 was rather insidious in the way that it was sort of thrust upon Californians. It was something along the lines of, I think the tagline on it was like, you know, safe schools, if I'm not mistaken. It was like the trying to get people, you know, to support this. And what it actually did is it reclassified a number of crimes as misdemeanors that honestly should have been felonies. It lowered the threshold for things like theft. And it actually increased the threshold for which misdemeanor theft would even, be prosecuted.
Is that worth like the $950 some odd? If you could explain that, that's a great example.
Right. Absolutely. So, I mean, we've actually seen in Los Angeles County people literally filling up duffel bags full of merchandise and walking out of a TJ Maxx because they didn't hit the $950 threshold of that. And the stores just have their hands tied as to what they can do. And even if they're arrested, they're turned back out because of the no bail policies that are essentially there. The Prop 47 also was deeply problematic in terms of being able to address the habitual substance offenders, getting them into programs that would actually help them and get them off the street. We've seen rises in homelessness as a result of this because there's nothing that the law enforcement or even the courts can do because it doesn't actually come to them anymore to a place where it's like, okay, we're going to jail you if you don't accept treatment, if you don't start taking, you know, corrective action, if you don't make choices that are going to be in line with societal order. They don't have that as a recourse anymore for being able to ensure services are received by those individuals. There's literally no stick anymore, and the carrot isn't sufficient to get those people that are not thinking in their right minds to behave in a way that would actually be in their best interest.
So is part of what you're saying that cops aren't even bothering to arrest these individuals because they'll be just let out and not even have the opportunity to go through like a substance abuse program, things like that?
I honestly do think that the law enforcement, by and large, as much as they can, will still arrest when there's a crime that they can arrest for. But there is a prioritization that I think takes place in terms of which call they're going to take first when they're getting multiple calls. And there is certainly a just demoralizing aspect to our law enforcement by the fact that they make these arrests and they're turned back out. I think that they are still taking the action that they can take and that they try to take, but it's having no effect.
I've talked to three cops that I know as friends, and I've asked them this specifically. And they said, William, he goes, people see homeless as like you look at a puppy. They don't realize these homeless have knives, they're wild, they're diseased. They don't realize the danger. So when we get a call, he goes, whether it's domestic abuse, I said homeless, but they talk about the homeless, the domestic abuse, where it's at, they go, they evaluate the danger now. And they go in their minds, is it even worth going out there? And he goes, everyone to a T said, we will go. How long it takes the average cop to now get there, though, is another story. And their point was, we'll let the beating take place and we'll go clean up. Because doesn't matter what we do, that person is going to be let out back on the street. He goes, one guy said, William, I got a family. Why am I going to risk my life to have a DA just let him loose or somebody sit there and state I did something or show, instead of showing the full 2 minutes of their video they take, they only show the 30 seconds out of context. Now, the reason I bring that up is because you're saying some of these felonies were reduced to misdemeanors. And so they're not doing this just because they don't want to do their job. They're doing it because they feel their hands are now tied. It's like, why should I risk my life to sit there and see somebody? Is that, I don't want to get into the moral issues here, but I just wanted to bring that up, is that's one of the effects that Prop 47 has had on our police force.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do think it's that demoralizing effect and the ability to not be able to feel as though their arrests or what they're doing is going to make a difference. And we're seeing that more and more, even in those homeless, you know, communities, if you will, and I use that term loosely, but I mean, you end up with a thuggish reality where you have basically the bullies of the homeless centers that essentially, yeah, I mean, you know, there's no protection for any of the crimes that are committed against one another. It literally becomes a survival of the fittest. And the number of attacks upon other homeless individuals because there's no law.
There's rape happening too with the women.
Anarchy on the street.
John, you can see it's all over the internet, but there's a couple of people who film outside of their apartments on Venice Beach, the homeless area. That's kind of like it's just a mm-hmm. strong strip, and somebody would be coming along with a bike, and a homeless guy who's just drugged out would just start chasing him down. And it sounds like Karen and I are demonizing the homeless. We're not, but we are putting a reality check on the true picture versus what people want to think of how it is. Again, that pragmatism. And that doesn't mean we don't want to help them. I look at it, it's kind of like shark confessing waters. Yeah, you know, sharks are nice to look at and study. But be careful when you go into those waters. The same thing with the homeless encampments. People have to be careful around them. And as I said, people don't realize the crime on crime within the home encampments. You're sleeping within my bed, so they shake. It's like prison. And the rape going on. And I'm not knocking you, but I'm saying you have a libertarian aspect. So sure. As a libertarian, sure, what do you think of all this?
Well, look, as a libertarian, my general statement is that crime is still crime. You know, so where I draw a division is between nonviolent victimless crimes as a libertarian. So typically speaking, vice crimes, sex crimes, gambling, things like that, I don't consider crimes because there's no victim, right? Now, if someone says, well, what about these sex workers who are held against their will? Well, that's kidnapping. That's enslavement. There's laws for that. We don't need to demonize those crimes, right, as crimes, those acts as crimes. But to the extent that people are robbing, assaulting, murdering, anything involving violence, anything involving aggression, theft, fraud, these things are crimes and they should be prosecuted as such. So I'm with you on that. I would just say that it's not where, again, I diverge a little bit is I don't think the state should be helping people necessarily, right? The state needs to protect our rights, not to provide services for people, right? People can help people. The government should just – they don't give us our rights. We have our rights. I have my right by virtue of being a human. I don't need the federal government or the state government to guarantee my right to bear arms. That's my right or my right to free speech.
They're not to infringe upon that right and actually try to strip it from you.
Absolutely. Right. They don't grant them. They can't – they protect them. Some people call it negative rights, which I hate that phrase. But, yeah, there are natural rights, a John Locke type of thing. But – So to the extent that should someone who comes randomly and punches me in the face to take my bike or to hurt my family or to steal my car, absolutely. They should be prosecuted. They should be put in jail.
Gotcha.
The question of bail to me, I would just say, look, someone who's not been found guilty probably shouldn't be in jail again for nonviolent crimes, in my opinion. Now, should they just be allowed on their own recognizance if they're likely to flee, if they're likely to miss their court appearance? No. So is it more a matter of reforming bail in the sense of the right amount given the financial? Maybe that's the answer as opposed to just turn everybody loose. Maybe there's a middle ground somewhere.
There's a counterpoint to the bail argument too, as I've actually talked to a number of bail bondsmen about this, and that is that if the right to bail is actually will guarantee that there is the potential for release. When there's actually no bail, you are entrusting that you will be released because of a, if you will, benevolent either court or sure. district attorney. But the idea, like your right to bail actually guarantees that you will be given the opportunity to stand trial as opposed to left in jail indefinitely sure. without necessarily ever coming, you know, to that trial date.
I don't disagree.
Kind of that two-edged sword.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I like I said, I'm not for the elimination of bail.
Right. No, I understand.
I think there's probably an opportunity to reform bail. So,
right.
because, like, as much as you know cops and everything, I'm very close with a lot of ADAs here in New York, and I have a lot of family members, and they flat out told me, look, we've knowingly set ridiculous bail with favorable judges because we don't want someone on the street. And a lot of times it's to further gather evidence, to give cops time to further something, right?
Right.
Or to have, or it's a backlog of cases, whatever the case may be, right? So I agree. My point, William, would just be don't prosecute victimless crimes, and be rather than eliminate bail, reform it to make it in line with the seriousness of the crime, I would say.
Right. Yeah. My only take on that is we act as if bail is an impossibility, but it's really, with the bail bondsman, they make life a lot easier. I mean, $1 million, you have to raise $100,000. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, yeah, but if you have $1 million bail, odds are you murder somebody, you know?
No, and again, that's appropriate in my opinion. Yeah. Right?
No, my whole point, though, is one side is putting it out as if it's a next to an impossibility. And what you stated is an abuse of the system by certain people abusing how the bail system works. The system itself could stand a little bit of tweaks to try to get that out of it, but sure. No system is ever going to be perfect. And that's what irks me about society. We expect all these systems to be perfect and they're not. Okay, but moving on. Go ahead.
I was just going to say one final comment just about what you were saying about the homeless. And, you know, I don't think there was any vilifying of the homeless that was actually taking place. And I think it's really important to note that what we're actually saying is compassionate to so many of them because their rights are being trampled upon by those bullies and abusers that are there because there is no law in those encampments. And that's what needs to be fixed. So even the most sympathetic, you know, to the homeless needs to recognize that if we don't actually do something about enforcing the law, then it only makes it worse for those that aren't having their rights, again, kind of thinking of John's point, protected in any way.
Right. And I agree. The reason I said that is because we are so divided. The moment you say anything negative, see, you're racist, you hate this, you are that, you don't like this. And I'm just trying to clarify. We're taking a realistic look at life and the reality of it. All right. So for people who don't realize, Gascon ran on a platform of racial justice, the focus on dangerous crimes, not misdemeanors, which is ironic because Prop 47 turned a lot of felonies into misdemeanors. See how that works? Doing away with cash bail or at least reforming it. That's what he ran on. And not putting criminals in jails, but using programs to reform them. I guess an example would be the substance abuse type programs. He accused his opponent of being too soft on cops and imprisoning too many people of color. A couple of points I want to say, then I want to get your opinions on this. He was running against Jackie Lacey, the first woman and first Black American that became the Los Angeles District Attorney. He was accusing her of being too soft on police and not prosecuting them. And then BLM targeted Jackie Lacey. Now, Jackie Lacey's pretty liberal. You know, she's not a full-blown leftist, but she's pretty liberal. And she'd go to the minority vote, you know, typical Democrat political card. And as a Latino, I saw that my whole life. So I feel comfortable. If y'all want to attack me, not YouTube, but whoever's listening, feel free. I'm a big boy. I can take it. Those were her politics. But the irony about it is Gascon was left of her. And BLM went with a white Cuban over a Black leftist. I just found that very ironic. And one more point before I get both your thoughts on that. Gascon never prosecuted a police officer while he was district attorney in San Francisco. So, just, Annie, this isn't, and now I'm asking you for comments, but this is more just political thoughts and how our world works today. I want to hear you, Karen, but let's get Big John out of the way. Big John, any thoughts on how that played out?
Well, look, the idea that law is blind is, that the law is blind, right? Justice is blind. Is something that we've held dear, at least philosophically, forever, right? Going back to the ancient Greeks. So the idea that it's
justice.
Yeah, but the idea that it's colored, pardon the bad pun, by people's racial viewpoints, for lack of a better term, this intersectionality. So look, Karen doesn't know, I'm a statistician, I'm a data scientist. So yeah, why are you putting more people of color in jail, statistically, there's more people of color committing crime in urban areas. So, yeah, if you just go by raw numbers, you're probably right, you know. But the safeguard against that should be the judiciary, right? And it should also be the jury system, right? We've got checks and balances in place that are part of the system. The problem is the corruption in the system, right? So the corruption that hides evidence that, you know, like on both sides, right? You have defense lawyers who it's their I was tempted to say fiduciary duty, but I don't know if fiduciary is the right word. That's more for financial stuff, I guess. But it's their duty to make sure they do everything in their power to make sure that their client gets the most vigorous defense possible. And you have prosecutors who at times seem hamstrung by the law that they're supposed to enforce, right? So there's that. Now, that allows for a lot of corruption, right? There's the opportunity for falsehoods, for lying, and for the twisting of facts. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And a lot of black men have been subjugated to that.
Oh, of course. Black men, Latinos, anybody non-white, let's be honest, has probably fallen victim. It's also cut not just along racial lines, but also economic lines. You know, the poor get the shaft more than the well-off.
I was just about to say, there's a lot of trailer park whites.
It's like that old Chris Lott, mayonnaise eating, trailer park living. You know, like go down the list, right? So, but the key to keep in mind is that's why you can't use intersectionality as your guide for who and how you're going to prosecute. Because first of all,
explain what you mean by intersectionality.
So, for example. Some people somewhere just have charts, right? Literally like those charts that tell you when to go for 2 points in the football game, right? Where they'll say, oh, it's 3 minutes left, you're on the five, you know, whatever, you know. The same thing here. For example, black, female, poor. Oh, that's a free pass, right? Or then they'll throw in, well, what about sexuality? Okay, homosexual, pansexual, asexual, that gets preference over cis, you know. Whatever. And when you start doing it like that, Jordan Peterson had a great question. What's the most important thing? And if you do try to look at all these different traits, you're going to end up a chart that has a 140 by 140 column chart. You know, you're going to go crazy trying to figure out where the one square is out of these thousands of squares, right?
But that's the whole point, John, is those charts in that playbook was thrown out the window because Jackie Lacey, being the black incumbent DA who used those tactics to get elected and reelected, found herself on the outside looking in. And that's what I found very ironic about it.
But I would say that I would argue perhaps that those charts were still in play, but it's just that what was on the top of the chart may have fallen a notch or two, right? So like the black woman who's straight may have, and I'm just making this up, right? It may have fallen to the spot below the Latino BLM supporter, because that's like a new opportunity. I'm just throwing that out there. But
Lacey said that she felt, I'm speeding up, but obviously Gascon's a DA, so we know that she lost an election. She felt she was a victim of racial politics because of George Floyd, and that history will look back on it and see it for what it was. Karen, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so my thoughts are that Gascon is doing a tremendous disservice to the communities of persons of color, because there's a disproportionate number of victims that are actually being victimized within those communities.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's not extraordinarily surprising that, you know, we see, you know, race on race crime. So it's not necessarily interracial in terms of who victimizes, you know, whom. You know, if you're in a impoverished community, you know, that the individual that is assaulting you or the individual that is committing a crime against you is very often of your same race. I mean, you know, there are cases where that's not happening, but, you know, definitely there is an occasion where, that certainly is, the case where the victim certainly is a person of color and is being victimized by another person of their same race.
You know that.
I'm sorry, William. I just wanted to sharpen that. So, do you feel like the defense against that institutionally is to remove all that sort of consideration for? So, like, I might argue that by removing it entirely, you're making it so neutral and so justice being blind at that point, right? Because
Removing what?
The consideration of all these different classes of victimhood, right? So color, race, gender, right? So, for example, I've always said, why do we need a Violence Against Women Act?
Okay, gotcha.
Right? Like, what about violence against women specifically isn't already covered by existing law?
Or hate crimes. You know, it's already covered.
Hate crime is my favorite because that's all political, right?
Yeah.
What part of a hate crime is actually new law that wasn't covered by existing statute? I don't understand. The only thing it seems to me that it's doing is you're finding ways for punishing speech you don't like as opposed to the act, right?
Well, I don't even think it's that, John. I just think it's a politician in a campaign mode creating a law that's already covered so he can go back to his constituents and say, look what I did.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. I'm pragmatic. I mean,
Fair enough.
Can layer it intellectually. I can. I'm not an intellectual like you two in that sense. I look at it more simplistically. And to me, it's politicians. And they do this every cycle. It's not just what we just mentioned. It's every cycle. It's a different cycle.
But those laws don't come off the books. That's the problem. Like,
well, yeah, of course. And we're talking laws from 100 years ago. What you did in the bedroom was illegal.
It still is in a lot of states.
Yeah.
It still is in a lot of states.
Right, right. Because they're still on the books. It's what you're saying. That's my point. It's just more laws, more laws, more laws.
I would say definitely more laws. And that can certainly be problematic. And I think that we would be far better served by, I think both John and William's point, you know, I think both of you are kind of saying the same thing. Let's enforce the laws that we already have on the books. We don't necessarily need to write more law. And
right.
I think that there's something very valid to that. I will differentiate just slightly between hate speech and hate crimes. I do think it is appropriate to look at the motivation for why someone committed a crime, because I think that, you know, that can be a factor. You know, did somebody, you know, and we actually already do look at this to a degree, you know, in terms of first degree murder, second degree murder, you know, was it a crime of, you know, passion, or, you know, was it a premeditated crime? If it was premeditated, what was the motive of that premeditation? So I think that there is a place for the discussion of motivation as it relates to some hate crimes that are there, which is far different than hate speech. And that I'm much more cautious about. I think that, you know, it is dangerous to actually really restrict the speech component. And I think we've seen that consistently upheld by the Supreme Court. Sunlight really is the best disinfectant. Let someone speak nonsense and be called out for that. But speech becomes action, that's a little different.
Absolutely.
Right.
But let me ask you this, Karen. Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it typically the case that motivation in those sort of violent crimes, isn't it typically used as a mitigating factor? So for example, you start out with the highest penalty, like, right, and then the mitigation comes in for that motivation, seeks to lower it, right? So isn't it that murder, for example, is up here? Let's say it's life in prison without parole. That's the maximum. And then, well, was it an act of passion, not premeditation? Well, okay, that goes down to murder too. And then was it manslaughter or depraved indifference?
Right, so definitely there is, I think, a component of that's there. I don't completely think it's inappropriate to actually heighten that as well, and actually perhaps make it a special enhancement. You know, I think that it's kind of like killing a cop. Okay, you know, murder is illegal, absolutely. Yet when the murder is of law enforcement, especially law enforcement, you know, that's in the commission of, you know, their duties that are there, I think that it is appropriate to consider that, because if we don't, then as a society, we are giving not necessarily a pass, because hopefully they're still prosecuting the crime,
right,
but there is a reason to emphasize that this particular crime is even more heinous than, you know, like I say, I think, you know, assaults against children, you know, that is warranted, you know, and I think that would kind of tie in a little bit about, you know, whether or not the crimes against women or not. I think that there is a place where we want to protect those that are traditionally in a more vulnerable position. And then you can make a case whether or not women are or aren't. And I mean, again, that's like the death penalty. It's a whole other discussion.
Right.
But I do think that there is a place where society says these are populations of people that are in need of of increased protection because they are in a vulnerable population. And sometimes that vulnerability has to do, again, with, you know, being of a lower socioeconomic standard. You know, I mean, it's a discussion to have as to where that is. And I think it's a little bit different than, if you will, your intersectionality model of, you know, squares. It's, as a society, what do we value? Who deems an additional warrantedness of protection? Now, unfortunately, I think that discussion has moved into a place where, instead of who do we want to protect, it's become who are we going to, you know, idolize, if you will, and who's going to be considered better in society, rather than it's an equality that exists. But because of that equality, we still, like I say, I mean, I definitely think that there should be added protections for children. You know what? They are more vulnerable, and that they are deserving of that. And we as a society should be protecting children. And if we don't, I think that we're failing as a society. And that doesn't mean that they're higher on an intersectionality square. Mm-hmm. It means that they need protection that we as a society should be giving them, and we should be doing that vehemently and zealously and passionately, because they can't always protect themselves.
Right. No, I agree. My final comment, and we're going to move on, is you brought up a good point with the cops. If you kill a cop and you don't punish well above, people are going to be targeting cops. And the reason I say that is, because on the flip side, we demand a higher standard from a policeman in how he deals with the public. So to me, it's a two-way street, and politics today no longer wants to be a two-way street. It's, what do I get out of it? So we're going to move on. So I'm going to do a little bit of talking here for the audience, because we're falling just a little bit behind, but Karen brought up a good point, and so did you, John. I don't know if you realize it. Statistically speaking, most people with the no cash bail or getting released or whatnot, and as Karen said, these just black on black, white on white, you know, these people go back to their communities, you know, and if they're not going to change their ways, which statistically, I forget what the number is, but it's a very high number, they don't, they're just going to bring crime back into their community. The reason I bring that up is Gascon ended up, when it was said and done, he had a $12 million war chest. Those are astronomical numbers in a district attorney's race. 2.5 million came from Soros's PAC. Patty Killeen / the wife of Netflix CEO Reed Hastings put in another 2 million plus. These are individuals who do not live in those communities. These are individuals who live in gated communities. They have their own security. And the reason I bring that up is because, again, I'm a realist. You know, I'm like, look who you're voting for. Look at the money backing them. So, and it didn't just extend to that. Gascon had Gavin Newsom as an endorsement. Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, who I can't speak for you two, but I believe are way out there socialist left, hardcore leftists. You know, so, and then he also had Gil Garcetti, the former district attorney, the current mayor's father. So he had all the power, all the money. And I can't help but feel that in seeing this, because I get depressed sometimes when I see politics, I'm like, oh my God, we're so screwed here and it's not going to change. I mean, I think we've all felt like that on both sides. That's just how politics are, the people like us who are invested. To see Lacey not have these endorsements that would traditionally become hers, and then to have what I call the final slap in the face. When she announced she was running for re-election, she immediately got the current mayor, Garcetti's endorsement, only to have it rescinded. And then not only that, Patrice Cooler, the co-founder of BLM, endorsed Gascon. And, oh my gosh, where's my notes? Oh, then to also see her endorsements by Adam Schiff and Ted Lieu, two popular hardcore leftists in California, rescind theirs. Now, they didn't endorse Gascon, but they rescinded theirs. And then at the state level, they have Assembly Speaker Adam Rendon, we send his endorsement. At the end of the day, it was just one pile on, one pile on. Yet, all that said, and I may be mixing up my dates like a Hollywood producer does to make it bigger than what it is, but she almost pulled it off in the primary. Now, I don't think all these endorsements were rescinded before the primary, but she managed to almost pull it off in the primary. In the primary, Big John, and to the audience, if you hit over 50%, regardless of how many right. people or whatnot, you outright win. Well, she's handily
– nonpartisan races. Right.
Yeah. Thank you. For nonpartisan races. And federal races, it's a top two and you're going to go in California. But Gascon only got 30%. Of the primary vote. And then something happened. And we all know what that was. It was George Floyd. And then these rescinding endorsements happened. And that's and Gascon ended up, because BLM was powerful. They were every week picketing. I say picketing because it's an uglier word. But they were in front of her house, in Lacey's house. They scared him one morning. And the husband of Jackie Lacey didn't know what was happening. He came out with a gun. I'll shoot you. And obviously that did not look good. That was the night of the primary. So everything went downhill. And I'm going to pull the hat, the rabbit out of the hat, and just say Gascon ended up in November taking 53.5% of the vote to Jackie Lacey's 46.5%. He had 2 million votes to her 1.7 million. That sounds close on paper to the layman, but in political terms, that was close to a blowout. You know, it's not a blowout, but he handedly won. There's not I need a recount or this or that. It was handedly won. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say, I will point out, because I think it goes right along with that, is that the LA County voters also voted to reinstate cash bail, and they did so at a higher level than Gascon won by. So
that was state. That was a state.
In LA County.
Gotcha.
Even in Los Angeles County, there was still a higher percentage of LA County voters that actually wanted to reinstate cash bail. So there was definitely an inconsistency in terms of understanding of what voters actually were supporting and who they were supporting and what they were getting. But you're right in terms of the fact that it became very much, again, it's that narrative. It was the picture. It was the repeated image of Jackie Lacey's husband pulling a gun on BLM supporters that essentially drove that messaging and that narrative, even though the same voters actually were voting for policies that weren't Gascon's policies.
And Big John, to inform you in the audience, Jackie Lacey, most of her financial backing came from like the police unions, cops, the older Hispanics who wanted law and order. So she was seen as a law and order. And with the George Floyd incident and then the husband pointing the gun, the narrative was written. That's law and order. See how they pull the gun on us innocent people, ignoring the fact that they scared the man at twilight, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, Karen. John, before you, I'm sorry, Karen. Yeah. I did cut you off.
It's fine. No. It was a good transition, actually. But, yeah, I mean, I would say that I think actually it was more that Jackie Lacey's husband was actually defending his wife even more so than he was, if you will, scared.
Right.
I think it was, get off my property and do not come after my wife. Was
he
the
did
way
say, I will shoot you. That did not help. I'm sorry. Big John. So I guess what I'm asking you, too, though, is the run-up and how this happened. To me, this is like Hollywood movie. What are your thoughts as political pundits on that? John?
You know, I would say, look, it was bad timing. You know, like sometimes the world happens, you know. I was going to say, like, look, the George Floyd thing was – we had a similar incident in New York, which was the Eric Garner choking out, you know, and – everyone in New York was shocked over that. You could have put in George Soros himself at that time, and most people would have voted for him because it was such an overt act of police misconduct, right? Like, literally, the way I tell people, the few people that were defending the cops, I said, they killed him over one cigarette, right? Even if the law is you don't get to resell cigarettes, he was killed over one cigarette. George Floyd was basically killed over a $20 allegedly counterfeit bill that he passed, okay? So if you want to – so to me, I tell people, would you put in a death penalty for counterfeiting a $20 for selling a cigarette? Most reasonable people would say no. So those two incidents, but the George Floyd especially, was very powerful, even to someone who's not a liberal, who's not a progressive like myself. Very powerful image. To be on the wrong side of that politically is a death knell, no matter how far on top you were, right? So
that's what happened to her.
Exactly, right? And then so it got turned on her, and then the image, like that couple in St. Louis when BLM came through a gated neighborhood and they stood there, it was a white couple, even though they were registered Democrats and they themselves were described as liberals.
Right.
The sight of a guy sitting there with his legally owned firearm saying, don't come anywhere near my property, that turned folks, you know, like
That emboldened both sides, because at that point, everybody's going to say, white America, but no. Americans with common sense who knew their rights and saw the danger of what happened, and they were starting to push back, and they got a lot of defense, and eventually it was either thrown out or dismissed or something.
Yeah, but I'm saying just the optics of that, though,
right,
were very powerful, right. And then you combine that with the Floyd incident, and, you know, then BLM is running like a juggernaut through anything, right?
Right, so, and yeah, that's because it was early on. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to put it in context. Early on, there's no stopping it. It was, like you said, it was a juggernaut.
So Jackie Lacey, and from what I've heard from you two tonight even, was it's not like she was Ms. Law and Order necessarily in the traditional sense, is what I'm gathering from you two. Like she
was definitely a comparative standard.
Yes, relatively speaking, I agree. But like, I wouldn't say she wasn't like a Giuliani or something, right? Like where when he was mayor of New York and like.
I don't think
it wasn't that tough.
Jackie Lacey was somebody who was out to protect people based off of race, color, or whatnot. I thought she was just a typical DA playing politics in terms of how any DA plays politics at that time, and she got elected during a law and order phase, meaning the people wanted law and order. Fast forward 10 years later, and the demo has changed in terms of the culture around the country and how they were looking at it.
I would agree, except for the fact that I think that when she was originally elected, she actually, I think it came as a kind of a contrast to, if you will, that extreme law and order, you know, narrative. I mean, she came after, you know, Steve Cooley, you know, was the DA. And I mean, he actually was actually running against Kamala Harris, for attorney general, and that didn't quite work out for him. Yeah, but, Jackie Lacey would come in, you know, on that, you know, on the heels of that. And, you know, for the next, you know, 8 years, you know, she, you know, was, you know, she prosecuted criminal offenders, and she.
But that's what I mean. She came in during a law and order phase, so that was more compared to what today's.
I guess I'm hesitant on that because it was around 2014 that we actually started to see some of the rollback of that, if you will, law and order phase. And yet, you know, she was, you know, still, you know, reelected in 2016. As was 2016. Because it was 2020, right? So it should have been 2016. So she was reelected during a time that there wasn't as much as that, like, hardcore, you know, law and order phase that I think of, you know, kind of the pre, you know, Prop 47s and, you know, that component that was there. But I mean,
she I agree with that.
Yeah, she was basically just kind of a straight shooter, though. I mean, like you say, she, you know, if there was a crime, it was prosecuted, you know. And, you know, she upheld the law, you know, and, you know, I think she would look for places for where reform was possible, but she wasn't trying to actually use the office of district attorney as a type of kind of activist.
I agree with that.
District attorney activism of changing the law as district attorney, which is clearly what we're seeing with Gaston.
Right. Okay. My whole point was, they were, as John says, they were able to frame it a certain way, you know, and the optics just did not help. But so in a nutshell, out with Lacey, in with Gascon. Goodbye, family values. Hello, Mason family values. Johnny Phillips, KABC radio host. Some of the tasks that, and I want to get your comments on these tasks, but I'll go ahead and mention them, not to seek the death penalty. Or Gascon's what he was going to do. Overhaul a conviction review unit that he would use to charge police. because Jackie Lacey never charged anybody. He issued a special directive, as we talked about, that misdemeanor charges shall be declined or dismissed before arraignment and without conditions unless exceptions. And as the audience knows, we already have seen where he just did not follow through with the exceptions. And we're going to, I want you to specifically comment on that. John, I want you to look at your notes because this is where I want your comment here. He issued on the misdemeanors, because I think you would agree with him on some of these. The trespassing, disturbing the peace, driving without a license, criminal threats, drug and paraphernalia, possession, minors with alcohol, drinking in public, under the influence of a controlled substance, public intoxication, loitering to commit prostitution, resisting arrest. Now, some of those I think you would agree, yeah, we need to toss them out. So I want to get your comments on that. Hold on. But in a nutshell, before he even did any of this, he did reward his people by meeting with the BLM members. Just a note to the audience. So we knew, I think we knew what we were getting. Some people now say, well, if I had known he was going to let people off just based on this, this, and this, I wouldn't have voted for him. And I'm like, are you dumb? That's exactly what he was saying in political language, you know. So, Cam, before we get to you, because I want to get John's hardcore libertarian thoughts. And to the audience, I'm not picking on John, but this is what when I find libertarianism fascinating, because it's a break from conservatism. Yes. That people don't always see this line. What do you think of some of those misdemeanors? Good call or not?
I don't even think some of those should be crimes, period, let alone misdemeanors or felonies. I look, prostitution, again, shouldn't be a crime. As long as everyone's doing everything consensually of their free will, go ahead. If you want to zone it in some way so it's not near, like, places of worship or schools or something, fair enough. But the act itself should not be criminal. Gambling, look, I'm for decriminalization of drugs, so there shouldn't be any arrests, either for dealing or using. That's just me. That's where, you know, like you said, that's where the libertarians kind of split from the conservatives. In that.
And why is this, again, the repeat of the audience?
Well, for me, it's a matter of self-ownership. You know, you own your body, you own your thoughts, you own your actions. Nobody else does.
And that gets to the core of the libertarian individual liberty belief.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. But see, it's coupled with non-aggression. So if you give me an example of, well, someone gets high and robs people to get high, I would say that person should be arrested, not because they're getting high, but because they're stealing, you know, like the same way I can't steal
right
to buy a book to learn how to be a coder, right? It's the same thing. The motivation shouldn't have any effect there. That's where what Karen spoke to before, where I disagree a little bit. But the other crimes absolutely should be crimes, you know, assault, threatening. But, you know, like trespassing, really, okay, give them a fine, you know, if there was no, you know, if they didn't.
And a lot of time that's what it is. Yeah. It's what they do while they're trespassing.
No, agreed. Yeah. Look, if they did B&E, if they bodily threatened someone, if they tried to rob or steal, that's a different issue. But, like, literally, I see someone sitting on my lawn, they need to be incarcerated for that. Look, I don't like people on my lawn. I'm a grumpy old man, but, you know.
Odds are, if you come out and threaten them and you have a shotgun, you're the one who's going to be going to jail.
Yeah, you're right. Right. Well, isn't that brandishing? Isn't that against the law? I don't know about California, but in New York, if you take out, if you take out a gun, even if it's legally registered, if you take out a gun just to scare someone, just to say, hey, back off or whatever, that you could be charged with, I believe, something called brandishing.
All I know is
you would get in trouble in that case. You have to be in fear of your life, right? It's that old thing, fear of your life, and there was no other opportunity to either. Look, it's not stand your ground in New York like in Florida, right? Yeah. You don't get to shoot someone even if your life is – if the jury thinks that you had the opportunity to run away,
but
you chose to shoot someone instead even in fear of your life, you're going to jail.
Well, staying your ground isn't just – people think it's a blanket protection. It's not. You know, people don't quite understand that law. Now, Karen, here's what I want to get out of you. If you can actually explain what a special enhancement rule is, because one of the issues that people immediately had with Gascon was he was looking into old cases as well and specifically targeting getting gang members back out on the street. He believes in rehabilitation. Whereas most of these gang members, once you're in a gang, you don't really get out. That is true, even in the Hollywood movies. So if you could explain what a special enhancement is and how this started to really destroy the fabric of law and order in L.A.
So the special enhancements are essentially those types of provisions on a crime that actually make it a little more heinous. They are what would add additional time to a sentence. It would take a, you know, 15 to life, 25 to life, and might make it a life without parole. This can include the addition of strikes. This can include, like I say, who actually may have been killed, motivation behind crimes, sometimes gang affiliations, the use of a gun and the commission of a crime. You know, all of these are components and elements to a crime that would be added as that special enhancement. So they're basically mitigating factors that would increase the reason and the rationale for sentencing on a particular, you know, crime that was committed. So when you talk about like the gangs, and I mean there are actually known cases where in jail cells, you know, basically, you know, Gascon is referred to, you know, as, you know, the homie of the criminals, because, you know, essentially his behavior is supportive of their early release, or that they're, you know, not being, you know, prosecuted to the fullest extent possible, you know, to getting these slaps on the wrist. And I think, you know, probably later on, you know, we'll be talking about, you know, some of those occasions where we've heard about what happened in jails. You know, we think of Tubbs and, you know, like, you know, his, you know, call, you know, to his dad about, you know, oh yeah, you know,
we're gonna get to that.
But all of those things are those occasions where you are not seeing a crime being enforced for the specifics of that crime. Again, much of what Gaston's problems is are these blanket policies. And, you know, each individual crime has elements of that crime that deserve to be examined and deserve to be prosecuted specific to that particular commission.
Correct. And for the audience, and Big John, he also did away with the gang unit. So the gangs were literally roaming free without a specialized police task force to keep tabs on them, because that's what they do, parties, keep tabs. So all of this snowballed, you know, a lot of felonies becoming misdemeanors, criminals or alleged criminals going back to their communities, and the crime went up. You know, I don't put 2020 on any of the Soros DAs, because those were monster crime numbers, because the election was in November. So, but crime and the murder rate did go up in 2021, and all this escalated, and to set you up, Karen, for something you have inside info, because you were so involved in it, and Big John, everything went south for LA, crime continued to rise, including homicides, a recall began. In July of 2021, a survey/poll emerged by J. Wallen Opinion Research. Listen to some of these numbers. 61% to 22% of voters said they prefer someone other than Gascon. There were 650 surveyed. 53% were Democrats, the core people that supported him. 17% GOP, and the rest, whatever. You know, whatever designation they give.
It essentially aligns with the demographics of Los Angeles County in terms of, you know, where you're going to find your percentages. So, yeah.
Right. So the survey found 42% would sign a petition to recall him. That translates to 2.3 million signatures that were out there to get, well above the 590,000. Now, the kicker here is Gascon's approval rating. 41% disapproved, 29% strongly disapproved, only 25% approved. 24, a lot of numbers here, but they all go one way. 24% viewed him unfavorably, while 17% viewed him favorably. Those are impressive numbers looking for people looking to oust him. Gascon, I guess the term politically is he was underwater when the first recall. Now, Karen was involved in the first recall, and this is where the knives will come out at Karen. This is where I know Karen, and I'll let her tell the story. How and why did this recall fail? John, you still with us? You get where I'm going?
I'm with you. I'm enthralled. I'm waiting to hear what happened.
Oh, there's probably a lot of reasons that could be put forth on that. But essentially,
well, let's start with the signature gathering.
Right, exactly.
Let's start with the signature gathering.
Part of it is a very daunting task. Okay, so, you know, In the first effort, almost 580,000 qualified signatures were actually going to be needed to be collected. And essentially that means that, you know, if you take into account what we call, you know, the qualification rate, because depending on how you collect your signatures, you know, there's a high tendency of either duplication efforts, signatures that are disqualified because they don't meet the parameters, something was abbreviated, someone used an address that wasn't a registered voter, they weren't actually a registered voter, they were registered in a different county. So there's a number of reasons why signatures can be disqualified.
Okay, so with that said, usually what is it, a 10% threshold, they try to get 10% higher than
usually you're going to run. Yeah, it's going to be a little higher than that. I mean, generally speaking, you know, a 70% validation rate is actually not terrible. Like I say, I mean, you hope for more like 75-80%. But I mean, you know, if you're running a 70%, you know, that's not
so 30% above the threshold is what you're saying.
Right, which means that, but basically we were looking to collect between 750 and 800,000 signatures, which basically breaks down to about 5,000 signatures a day because you have a 160-day window in which to collect the signatures.
Gotcha. Now I'm going to go back to the original number though. You had 2.3 million individuals who said they were willing to sign. So the numbers were out there.
So that particular poll actually came out in July, which is about halfway through the process. So the first petition was approved on May 21st, and it had until October 26th or 27th to actually qualify.
And Big John, there's a time limit. We always have a time limit on the
petition. Exactly. Correct. So the poll came out about halfway through. And about that point in time there, well, I'm not really going to comment on the number of signatures that were actually collected because it seems to be somewhat questionable because they weren't turned in. So
were signatures turned in or not?
There were zero signatures that were turned in based off of the first round effort to recall Gascon.
Okay, right. I'm not moving on, but to tie that in, that tells me there was some internal – something was not working internally. I don't want you to put anyone on the spot. I don't want you to put yourself on the spot. But were the internal squabbles pretty much responsible for this failed recall?
No. I mean, it didn't help it, but and it certainly was a easy scapegoat and a reason to make it the blame for why it was not successful. And there's a component of that that's not entirely true, but the reality is that it was a strategy aspect that resulted in the failure of the first effort. And
what was that strategy?
Right, I'm getting ready to tell it, and I'm going to say, yeah, and hopefully it gets corrected in the second effort. The second effort's about now a month in, and if we don't see a change in strategy, there's a concern about what that means, because we've just spent an hour discussing all of the reasons why Gascon should be recalled. There's a ton of earned media on this. There's a ton of polling information that if people know about Gascon, they would be inclined to sign.
Right.
Here's the thing. Voters across the board, but especially in California and especially in Los Angeles County, are generally apathetic and uninformed and poorly educated. We're a very educated bunch that are here. There are certainly politicos that are following this. There's a lot of deputy district attorneys that want him gone. In fact, actually, they just voted to support the recall. 83% turnout, which is one of the highest turnouts of in an election, and 98% of that 83% that voted wanted him recalled.
Right, that's for the current recall.
Exactly. Right. Well, that's just, you know, right, for his recall. And so
what's the failed strategy here?
Right. So all of that to say that people who know Gascon want him out. Law enforcement wants him out. Victims want him out. Okay. These are people that follow who he is. But you know what? The kind of, you know, Jane Doe on the street probably can't tell you who the district attorney of Los Angeles is. Maybe she's heard his name by now. Because like I say, there is some earned media and it's getting some attention. The mayoral candidates are starting to talk about this. So it's picking up some hype. Now that doesn't translate though into those 2.3 million voters of Los Angeles County that would sign the petition to actually get up off their rear ends and actually go find a, you know, polling or find a booth, you know, that petition booth, that has the petitions and to sign it. Doesn't mean that they're going to go online, download a petition, sign it, mail it in. I mean, that's a lot of work for somebody that might have heard Gascon's name and, yeah, maybe doesn't like him once they hear about it.
So what you're saying is they were waiting for the people to come to them, correct, not go to the people.
Correct. Yeah. And that's still, unfortunately, the strategy that we're seeing. if there is not a more conscientious and concerted effort to start knocking on doors, and that, again, we need to be smart and targeted about this. We're not going to knock on every door, but there's good data out there to suggest who those 2.3 million are that are going to sign.
Oh, the data, and we, there's we not good data. It is data. Out there.
Right. We need 500 and call it 70,000. It's like 566,857 qualified signatures. And I'll add to this as well, that if we're knocking on doors, we know who the registered voters are in those houses. So that's going to up our qualification rate. So we should be able to move that from a 70% qualification rate to more like an 80 or an 85% qualification rate. And that means that we actually need fewer signatures than maybe the 800,000 or the 750,000. Right. And maybe we can get it done in 700,000 signatures because we still want that buffer.
Okay. But
a month in, we're still just seeing a lot of boots is what we're seeing.
Current recall. Correct. Now, but I want to stick to this recall first. I'm a political pundit. I got involved 2015 locally. I'm not an idiot. I'm a pragmatic. I have a college degree. One of my strengths is understanding the big picture and understanding the internal mechanisms of teams and how they work. It's what's helped me be successful. And the reason I say that is because everything I just said really isn't rocket scientist or rocket science. And the one thing that really irked me that I saw as a constituent who did not want Gascon there. Actually, he's not my constituent. I'm not his constituent, but as somebody who wants a better California, was that there was an official recall group. Now, I know for a fact in grassroots, in politics, there is no official nothing unless you're the official candidate nominated by your ex party or your, you know, party X here, party X there. That's it. You know, so as soon as I saw publicly, we are the official recall. And then they were demonizing others. That's when I knew, excuse my French, this shit ain't gonna work. That's what went through my mind. Now, a couple of questions. That's internal politics, but I would guess that that's one major reason the first recall was never able to get it together and to get it passed. So what's your thoughts on that briefly? But more importantly, because this is important to me, because this is why I was telling you, John, earlier off camera, the Republican Party, especially the Republican Party elites in California, they may have money, but they're still grifters. How much money was raised and what happened to that money? So briefly, because I do want to move on, but to me, this is very important.
So the first effort raised $1.4
million. $1.4 million, the lotto, baby.
Yep, and from the committee that raised that, there's now I believe between $50,000 and $75,000 left. It was essentially all spent, you know, by and large, and a significant portion of that, I believe it was about $700,000. I would encourage everyone to go back and pull financial records. You can get them from the LA County Registrar of Voters website. They're, you know, like I say, all of the committees that have received donations have their financial statements listed. So don't take my word for it. Always, you know, be a good scholar and research. But you will find that there was a significant portion of the funds that went to a entity called Silver Streak LLC. And Silver Streak LLC was a signature collection firm. They also happened to be the same signature collection firm that was actually working on the recall Bonin effort.
Hold on. A signature collection firm, I'm dumbing it down for people with my mentality. Signature collection firm, 700 some odd thousand went to, and yet not one signature was turned in. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Okay, please go on. Right.
There was an attempt to turn in signatures, but with both groups not necessarily being present to turn the signatures in, none were accepted by the Registrar of Voters office on October, I believe it was 26th or 27th. I have to look back at my calendar. I think it was October 27th.
And for the audience, this is what I call the grift, the signature collection firm. To me, that is a great example of what in California politics is a grift.
The only thing that would make it better, William, is if you found out that LLC was owned by George Soros.
for the audience, me and John had a mini battle. He's like, every other conservative always blames Soros. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. But a lot of times it's true. You know? Okay, so in essence, Karen, this recall with noble intentions ended up to me becoming a grift. You're not saying that. I'm saying that. But at the end of the day, it did not work. We are now in a current second recall. I want to hold off on that because there's a few steps prior. Big John, I view this as the potential beginning of the end. That's the optimist in me for George Gascon. But we don't know what's going to happen. Gascon's policy gave the ADA's discretion to follow the spirit of Gascon's policies with their own discretion to not charge. However, they did not have that discretion when they wanted to add enhancements. So that ended up forcing the ADAs, who were also being demeaned, they're protected, so he can't just fire them like in other Soros DAs did with their ADAs. They went to court. The court found in favor of these ADAs and said that Gascon had, in essence, they said, no, Gascon, you do not have the power to not follow the law. Am I correct in that aspect? Now, they're successful in court, but the ADA say Gascon is lying. Karen, why would they say that?
They said that Gascon was lying in terms of, I'm sorry.
I apologize. They said that the court came back and told Gascon, you have to follow the laws. And Gascon right. came about, let's take one step back and now talk about Tubbs. You know, let me get my notes here.
No, it's fine.
I don't want to screw it up.
While you're pulling your notes, I think what you might be saying Hannah is Tubbs. That there was a couple of different aspects to the case that the judge did uphold for the ADA, the DDAs that were there. So it was it's the LAADDA entity that was taking Gascon to court. But the main thing that was upheld.
But in essence, these were the people who worked for Gascon in the DA's office.
Yes, okay. Exactly. It's the Los Angeles Association of Deputy District Attorneys.
Okay. Now, before you mention, so the reason I waited on this is, one of the things that he promised before the election, and he did follow through, is he would not try juveniles as adults. And that brings us to Hannah Tubbs, a resident of California. Now, if you can fill us in on Hannah Tubbs and what went down with that.
Sure. So Hannah Tubbs was formerly James Tubbs at the time that the assault in question took place that has caused the most controversy.
So he's a transgender, or she's the transgender. Right.
Right. 17 years old, 2 weeks shy, I believe. I think it was 2 weeks. It was maybe a week to 10 days to 2 weeks shy of the 18th birthday. A New Year's Day in 2014, assaulted a 10-year-old in a Denny's bathroom with, you know, a forcible penetration. And, you know, definitely traumatized. It was manual, but I mean, it was, you know, still a very traumatizing experience for this, you know, 10-year-old who doesn't really want to talk about it, but has at least voiced, you know, concerns. Gascon tried to use that to say that, you know, she refused to testify, which was not entirely the case. Like I say, she's given statements. I mean, she has made it clear, you know, what was, you know, going on with this. So essentially, Tubbs was not actually arrested until 26. He got picked up on a cold DNA hit. I believe that that's the case. You, again, might want to double check.
2019. It went unsolved until 2019. He was arrested in Idaho.
There you go.
On suspicion of battery.
And so once that was discovered, did come back down for those charges. But at this point in time, he now is she. So James is now Hannah and is ready to term out of essentially juvenile facilities. And because Newsom has essentially shut down much of those transitional juvenile facilities, there's not even really a place to house a, you know, 26-year-old that is on juvenile charges, you know, for this. And so essentially it was 2 years home confinement, no sexual offender, you know, registering that was going to be necessary. And it kind of probably would have just gone away if not for getting the press attention that it has gotten.
That's the phone calls that were tapped into somehow. I mean, it was legal.
That was part of the press attention, right? Yes. Yeah.
Right. And explain what happened there. But in essence, he pretty much had no regard for what he had done, no remorse.
Yeah. Right? I mean, there was one comment that suggested that, but essentially what, you know, what Tubbs actually told the father was that I'm not going to have to register. I'm, you know, going to be done with this, you know, and out, you know, as soon as, you know, like I say, it was essentially 2 years, you know, and there's not going to be, you know, any record of this because it's going to be in a juvenile sealed record. And, you know, it's just going to, it's going to disappear. And that's how, right. That's how Tubbs described it.
Well, let me add to that. And you're a political beast too, Karen, but what's happened is, it's the tone, how he said it, the chuckling.
Oh,
absolutely
yes.
No remorse. Because to me, it's like, that's not what bothers me. What bothers me is the sentencing he got. I mean, that's what I expect a criminal like him to talk, but that's what shocked Americans and the constituents. And that's what got the ball rolling, is that. And now back to my original screw up there, because I had to add order. So what this, so Gascon originally, Big John was like, well, whatever. You know, that kind of was his take for a few days. Then, hey, we're your polling company here. This is what's happening. And all of a sudden, Gascon's go, well, you know, after talking to the constituents and victims, which he never really did, he is introducing committees. And that's also based on not complying with the courts, but telling the courts, hey, I'm going to take your decision and saying I have to follow the law, and here's what I'm doing. Now, the ADA say he's lying because it's going to be his people on those committees, and they are. So, for example, his chief of staff, who is under a current DWI or was arrested for public intoxication or something, is the head of one of these committees. So are the ADAs correct, Karen, in stating this is just a smokescreen because he's still going to use his power to not add special enhancements to the cases going forward?
So, I mean, essentially, it is all a ruse. It doesn't essentially change his policies. It just gives cover for being able to still keep them. I mean, perhaps in the absolute most extreme cases, like I say, you have to have like a unanimous decision, you know, to go forward. And when there's a unanimous decision to go forward, you know, then it will. But right, when you stack the committee and you can ensure that there's not going to be that vote that is going to, you know, make it unanimous, then, you know, it's going to get held up in red tape, and it's going to get, you know, held up in bureaucracy that essentially is there. You know, what actually, you know, happened was, is Gascon tried to say, well, we're going to have some policy adjustments, is the way that he referred to it. So, you know, we're going to continue forward with the reforms, because quite honestly, he was going to start to get blowback from both sides. You know, you have his, you know, supporters that are, you know, hey, you campaigned on, you know, A, B, and C. And again, I still think that he's actually gone far beyond several of what he did campaign on, but certainly he did campaign on some of this. And so you have those that expect him to do this, to not backtrack and, you know, to be, you know, bold and, you know, to, you know, hold that line. So he can't just completely back away from that. So he sets up these committees so he can still basically give a talking point, if you will. He can say, oh, this is what we're doing in response to his critics. Yet those that are supporters of his know that nothing's going to change in practice.
Right. He actually came out and said, hey, I'm not changing. I'm still going to pursue what I promised the people I pursue. And as a political junkie here, I believe the only cases that he'll allow special enhancements to be added on are cases that could potentially blow back on him. If there's going to be no blowback, he is not going to sit there and have special enhancements, because they still have to give I'll give one example before we move on. It's normally standard when a defense attorney goes, hey, or puts a paperwork in or requests to have the juvenile taken out of adult court. It's standard for the prosecutor to just immediately file, no, we disagree with this, yada, yada, yada. Now they can't. They have to go to the superiors. So he's not changing. And that's a good example of showing why, because he's still not letting them do what is a normal procedure. Now, a couple of points before we close it out with Karen's thoughts on the current recall. He is also being sued for derogatory statements. And this is a bit of a political segment here, very brief, a couple of minutes. But Gil Garcetti won his first term as LADA by being demoted and then using that to attack and be seen as the underdog, yada, yada, yada. He won. Served another term. then that was used against him. Now, this current assistant district attorney is suing for defamation. He has 5 points. I saw some of the things Gascon said. I'm not a lawyer, but I talked to a lot of lawyers, and I stayed at a Holiday Inn. So I can tell that some – I'm like, whoa. I mean, he's pretty much calling them incompetent and useless. And the thing about Gascon, he's a dirty dog in terms of how he goes to war. He cuts – I mean – very offensive, some of the comments he says, because he wants it to be that way. So I think the guy may have a case. So, Karen, do you think that this incident with Tubbs, the court decisions, this lawsuit, do you think that could start the ball rolling to fast forward? Let's say he's in election mode. We'll get to the recall in 1 second. But do you think this could actually end his reign as DA?
I think 2024 is a totally different political landscape, and it really is almost impossible to predict. You want to hold off talking about like the recall, what that's going to look like for a second. So if we're looking at these events right here as to whether they would result in him not being reelected in 2024, if there was no recall, and if that's not the point that we're looking at right here, I think that so many things can change in the course of the next 2.5 years, but before that November 2024 election, even potentially though, I mean, that there'll be a primary election in 2024, it'll be a March primary because it's a presidential in California. So they alternate March and June. This year is a non-presidential, so it's a June primary, but March of 2024, where are crime numbers at that time? What else has happened? I think right now, to your point, though, there's a lot of earned media against Gascon. And I think that's why it is warranted to look at that as it relates to the current recall. I think that's really where we can discuss the political landscape with the data that we have and the facts that we have and the events that have been in the media that we have.
All right. And, John, I want to get your thoughts on that, but real quick. What some may not know, some of the sources, DAs have already been up for re-election. And despite crime going up, both in 2020, which is not really their fault, but the BLM, all that stuff, but 2021, crime and homicides were still going up. Yet Soros DAs were easily re-elected. 2020 in Philadelphia, the highest crime rate in the history. The ambulance chaser gets elected DA. He goes, 2020, the highest crime or the highest homicide rate in our history? Hold my beer. Because 2021, it was even higher, and he still won by like 60 to 40%. So the Soros DAs are still getting reelected. I think part of it's what you said, Karen, the apathy of the voter and not knowing who these DAs are. But, John, do you think, based off your belief as a libertarian in how we are as humans in this country, do you see him coasting the reelection in 2024, not thinking about a recall yet?
Oh, no. Not even being involved in California politics like you two.
Oh, but you have a New York DA that's in a similar position.
Sure. Well, look, 2 years is an eternity, like politically, right? So I agree with Karen 100%. People are not going to remember what in 2024 what happened in 2021, 2022. Forget it. That's a reality, right? There's a reason why 95% of incumbents get reelected in any political scale, right?
So ridiculously short-term memories. Yep.
Very short-term memories, franking privileges, the power of the office they hold. There's a lot of reasons why incumbents really get to hold on with a death grip, right? So lacking a recall, I don't know. But it's also, don't forget, how people feel about the environment. And a lot of that is tied into the economy. So, you asked for my libertarian thing? Look, I've been complaining about deficits causing inflation for years. It's finally hit.
Oh, like, yeah.
Me and Peter Schiff are finally right. Okay, so the inflation has hit. It's going to get worse, a lot worse before it gets better. And unfortunately, there's no Reagan in office. There's no Milton Friedman talking in his ear to calm inflation down by letting interest rates
rise. Or even a Bill Clinton.
Right? So, huh?
Or even a Bill Clinton.
Well, Bill Clinton Bill Clinton had the line item veto. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, he had a lot more power than presidents do now of either party. But My point is, if California is on the economic trajectory that I would assume all three of us, despite our differing philosophies, agree California is on, right, that's another thing that's an X factor, right? Because even if people have short-term memories, if they can't afford to get milk and bread at the corner bodega, that's going to put them in a foul mood. So to that extent, how much does that trickle down, like, say, to the DA's race, the mayor's race, the governor, you know, whatever? I think that's an underlying thing people tend to ignore. Is like, if the
right.
Look, and, give them credit. Clinton said it best. It's all about the economy, right? So,
and so well, eventually, to your point, John, I agree. And Karen, and both of you are right in the short memory. John, you're right with inflation, and we all agree on that. Even my dumb knock in my head understands how inflation works. And I'm with you. I'm like, it's coming, it's coming. Yeah. And I'd always be, it should be here, but it finally is here. It's not a good thing. But I think that's going to, if Gascon and these other DAs continue the mentality they currently have, which they will, because the ones that have already won re-election, you kind of become unbeatable, invincible in your mind. But I think we are looking at New York City in the 1970s around these huge urban areas, Chicago, Houston, LA,
Detroit.
And so I think if that continues, they're out. So let's close it out with the recall. What's it going to take for this second recall? Because honestly, life is about opportunity. There's a great book, Outliers, by Malcolm Gladwell, Gladwell. Phenomenal book. The whole book is based on right place at the right time. John knows about this. We've talked about this. I think with everything that's happening with Gascon, this recall is poised perfectly to succeed. What's it going to take to succeed? And in your opinion, you don't have to tell us if it will or not, but where do you think it's leaning?
So there's two components that I see as being significant factors in this. One, are we going to collect the signatures that are going to be necessary to even get it onto the ballot? We're a month in on this particular, you know, recall. It qualified, I think it was January 27th. They have until July 6th to collect 566,857 signatures, so a little bit less than the first effort. It hasn't yet been a number released on how many signatures have been collected in the first month. That's going to be a factor. How fundraising continues, you know, for that, how they use those dollars. Because, you know, we talked about how they were used in the first effort and whether or not that changes, as to how they're used in the second effort. If it's going to be effective and successful, what are we actually seeing? And so it's a little soon to be able to tell. The concern right now is that we don't have a lot of data. And without that data, it's hard to be able to draw a conclusion. The other concern that is present is if it does end up on the November general election ballot. That there was a bit of a discussion kind of, you know, before
the recall vote itself, if they get the signature.
Right. So if you collect the necessary number of signatures and depending on the approval and the calendar that goes along with that, the push right now is for it to be on the November general election ballot. There was a little bit of a debate, like I say, prior to the petition being approved and the timeline for that, as to what would have been better. I'm actually a supporter, and I'll stand by this and actually still call this out, that if there's any way that it can get slowed down or delayed, I don't think it'll happen, because I think no matter what, the county is going to try to get it onto that November election, general election ballot. But it would have been more advantageous if it does qualify to have got it on the December ballot. We actually want a lower turnout for this. We know that when there's a high turnout, it favors Gascon. That's how he got elected in 2020. We know that there's going to be an absurdly record high in 2022. You still have every voter in California. Obviously, that means Los Angeles County getting a vote by mail ballot. There's an increased, ability to harvest those. And I mean, that would be a whole other segment, a whole other conversation to be had in terms of, you know, the ballots that will get
turned.
But we know that there's going to be a very contentious, very partisan, November general election. And there's going to be a high voter turnout as a result of this. And in Los Angeles County, the demographics are even less favorable than they are in the state. And so overcoming those demographics on that November general election very much concerned me. So obviously, I want it to qualify. I want it to get onto the ballot. definitely would have thought that a December election rather than a November general election would have been far more advantageous. We know that. We actually saw one of the successful recalls of Josh Newman, and it worked because the voter turnout in his recall election was significantly lower than either of his two elections.
And for the audience, Josh Newman was a state senator in California. Right. Real quick.
It did overlap with Los Angeles County as well.
Right. So. The reason I think this is the right time, the mayoral candidate Rick Caruso and LA City Councilman Joe Buscaino have both endorsed the recall. As you stated earlier, the ADA's their negotiation, their negotiating committee or group or whatever you call it, about 800 plus members, 83% of them voted in this special vote to determine if they would support Gascon. 97.9% voted to support the recall.
Right.
You know, 30 cities in the county have given a no confidence
32
vote.
Now. 32.
32 cities now have given a no confidence vote. So that's why I believe the moment is right. And I hated to steal your thunder there at the last.
And I hope that you are right. Like I said, the first step is are we going to get the signatures for it? That's going to be a key. The other thing that we should actually, and we opened with this, so it kind of makes sense to kind of wrap up and close, is we will see how the Chesa Boudin recall goes on the June 7th primary. You know, that
election. Who is he and where at?
I'm sorry?
Who is he and where? What city?
San Francisco DA. We talked a little bit about him at the very beginning. So his recall is actually qualified and will be on the June 7th primary ballot. And so that will be fairly representative to a degree. I mean, it's going to be a lower turnout. And it's actually going to be more conservative because primary races, you know, especially in a midterm, usually get a little bit better. So if that one succeeds, then that's going to boost efforts for the Gascon recall as well. If it fails, that it's San Francisco, it's still a little bit different,
but they had a special election recall of board of school board members. This is the leftist of the left, you know, the most socialist of the socialists. This is where the Democrats call themselves socialist Democrats. Hardcore leftists on the school board, and they were recalled, all correct. Three of them. And it wasn't even close.
But it was a special election, low voter turnout. That
I understand
support
that.
The reason for that. Right.
I understand that. But we're talking the leftists of the left here. There's certain lines you don't cross. Parents become one-issue voters when you screw their kids over.
Which
and I think crime is something at a local level that can become a one-issue, make somebody a one-issue.
And especially if we put the emphasis on the kids and the need to protect the kids, because right now the kids aren't being protected. And that was certainly a talking point worth continuing to emphasize.
Any final words there, Big John?
First of all, I want to thank Karen. This has been a great, for me, because it seems like the only state I ever hear about recall petitions are in California. I don't think I've ever – I'm pushing
– We're actually one of the easiest states to get the recall.
I think that must be it, because I my entire life I've lived in New York. I haven't heard the one instance of a recall. I mean, I'm sure there may have been. I just haven't heard of any.
California Constitution got it right, and hopefully the state legislature doesn't screw it up.
Yeah.
Now we have a lot of recall attempts. But we rarely ever have actual successful recalls.
Right. But you know what? It gives people at least the illusion that they have at least some say in their government. So to that extent.
I don't think it's an illusion. It's a matter – it's there for the people to take. The problem is the – is that the right word? The apathy of the people?
Yeah.
Look, a big word I used.
Yeah. Well, it's like my philosophy professor asked me once. He said, hey, John, what do you think is worse, ignorance or apathy? And my answer was, I don't know and I don't care.
Well, Karen, I want to thank you so much. And to be a little honest here with Big John and to the audience on the podcast outline, I said I put an hour. I knew that was not true. I knew we would approach 2 hours, but I knew it would be fun, exciting, knowledgeable, and there would be no drifting. You educated us. You were honest about a lot of things. And if anything else happens with the Soros DAs or with Gascon, we'd love to have you back.
It was my absolute pleasure, gentlemen. I thank you very much for the opportunity to be able to chat with you this evening. Really enjoyed myself as well. So thank you so much for having me. And certainly would always be thrilled and privileged and honored to return if the opportunity presents itself. So thank you both very, very much.
Thank you so much, Karen. It was great talking to you.
Great talking to you both.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care.
And there you have it, people. Ms. Karen Roseberry. Karen is a hardworking activist. There's a lot of daggers pointed her way because she's a strong woman. She's a feminist in her own right, but a feminist who just believes in choice. That's my take of her. Not one of these feminists who thinks this way. And in our world, that makes her a target of some at times. But she's strong. She knows her stuff, and we're grateful to have her. And to the audience, thank you for being with us again. Big John, as always, thank you for your libertarian viewpoint and just your viewpoints in its entirety. And for everyone else, I am William Del Pilar with Big John, and we are with sportsgrumblings.com. Visit as we post articles weekly and give us your feedback. You know, post something on the site. Let us know how we're doing and how we can improve. Everyone have a good night.
Peace, America. We'll be right back.